From the first ever semi-official pagan response to Christianity, the Logos Aletheis by Celsus, 178 AD. The Christians claim that they alone know the right way to live, and that if only the children will believe them, they'll be happy and their homes will be happy as well. Now if, when they're speaking this way to the children, they happen to see a school teacher or parent coming along, these Christians flee in all directions. They also tell the children that they should leave their fathers and teachers and follow the women and their little chums to the wool dresser's shop or to the cobbler's or to the washerwoman's shop so that they might learn how to be perfect. By this logic, they've persuaded many to join them. That was a reading from the Logos Aletheis by Celsus, 178 AD. Now, first of all, keep in mind that this document was supposed to have been written nearly 150 years after the death of Jesus, meaning that at this time, Christianity is supposed to be in like its fifth or sixth generation. Now, if you were to go to the store this week and pick up literally any book off the shelf that discusses the early history of the church, you'd be told that at this time, around 180 AD, the Christian church was a thriving organization. With organized communities in every major city, it had specific initiation rites, it had a clearly defined theology, it had bylaws and procedures in place, right down to the seating arrangements in the individual churches. Yet when we read this, our first actual testimony from an external observer, it sounds distinctly like we're reading about a failed multi-level marketing scheme. And one that's actually failing so hard that its marketing department seems to have decided that the only viable strategy going forward is to focus on converting kids, basically. Kind of like a blue ocean strategy. And in the rest of his book, Celsus gives us the picture of Christianity as a belief system that's more in line with the run-of-the-mill religious charlatanism, kind of backstairs conjuring that was the main cultural product of that period, and we see it everywhere in the second century. You know, you had celebrity magicians that could manifest a fully grown snake from an egg. You could buy amulets to wear around your neck with names of gods and nonsense magic words plastered on them. A lot of these are focused on making someone fall in love with you, and these were as common as the impulse items by the cash register in our time. You could pay a necromancer to put you in touch with a deceased friend or relative. In some cities, this was about as easy as it is to find an essential oils place in the modern era. And whenever pagan writers noticed Christianity in this early period, it is almost always in the context of wandering magicians, wandering exorcists who will heal you with a magic word, a wave of the hand, invoking the name of Jesus, and even the New Testament reflects this. Celsus talks about Christian priests using silks and curtains, stones and plants, magical formulas and the names of demons and their conjuring. The key takeaway from this reading is that Christianity in the mid-second century looks like a common salvation cult dealing heavily in magic, which is now in the process of expanding. But above all, the religion appears to still be in its earliest days. The Christians in the time of Celsus seem to understand that they are most successful with this new demographic, which is children, but at this time, wouldn't there already have been a steady stream of children entering the church via their own parents? If Christianity had already been around for a century and a half, there wouldn't have been any need for this kind of activity. And this is just one example among very many that should give us pause. You know, we sometimes get a hint of the true state of things when we read certain documents like this. It's like a Philip K. Dick novel about an alternate reality that's breaking down, and here and there, bits of the true reality begin breaking through the barrier. You're listening to Born in the Second Century, and the date is now November 25th, 2020. This is episode 1. I'm the host, Chris Palmero, and the music for today's broadcast was provided by Tom Stallcup of the recording group Pompey Gray. Today seems like a good day to criticize the New Testament. Jesus and the apostles are mythical figures, and the true beginning of Christianity is to be found not in the early first century, but in the second quarter of the second century. That is between 125 AD and 150 AD. Early Christianity as we know it was born in the second century, nearly 100 years later than is commonly claimed. And we're going to demonstrate this not through conspiracy theories of Renaissance forgeries, not through confused astrophysical speculations, and not from a position of reaction or anger or mere contrarianism. But we're going to demonstrate it through a close reading of the New Testament and of the paracanonical writings from both Christianity and Judaism and of the contemporary Greco-Roman testimonies. Until now, when we've thought about the origins of Christianity, we've assumed certain things, and we may not even be aware that we're assuming them at this point. We've assumed that Jesus was a historical teacher of the early first century who was crucified and died under Pontius Pilate. We've assumed that he appeared to his closest disciples in a vision after his death. We've assumed that his disciples spread the message of his cross and resurrection throughout the empire. And we've assumed that all of this happened by the end of the first century. These assumptions come from nearly 2,000 years of habit, and we have to ditch them entirely if we want to know how Christianity truly began, because there's an unsettling feeling that we start to get when we actually read the early Christian documents from beginning to end. It's a feeling that the origin story of the religion that we've always been told, that we think we know, frankly doesn't make any sense. And to address that feeling, to find the truth, we have to jettison our assumptions and really read these texts, as it were, for the first time. And when we finally listen to what they have to say, we can begin to hear the true story that these earliest Christian books are trying to tell us, that this new religion, this breakaway sect from Judaism, was still in its infancy as late as 150 AD. There has to be an alternative way of explaining how Christianity began, one that takes all the evidence into account, one that addresses the many contradictions and problems that arise when we try to read these books in the conventional way, and above all, one that explains why Christians or Christianity are not even a blip on the radar of the general consciousness of the Roman public until over a century later than we should expect. And scholars from the past have raised these questions, but their achievements are ignored by mainstream Christians in our time. Their efforts represent an abandoned road that we have to take it upon ourselves to follow. And today we're going to follow one of those scholars in particular, Gordon Rylands. I call him Saint Gordy. And he'll kind of be the Virgil to our Dante in today's brief foray down the abandoned road. He is a guide, but our theory departs from his in a few fundamental ways and takes newer discoveries and newer scholarship into account. But by the end of today's broadcast, anyone who listens can learn about how everything that we're told about Christian origins comes from a fictional narrative that was developed by the early church to explain the circumstances of its own founding. Christianity, as we know it, as it emerged from the second century, was just one strain of a Jewish heresy that survived. And the main reason for its survival was that it was able to get everyone to believe that all of its rival strains either never existed or were unfortunate deviations that the church management dealt with fairly handily, almost like they were dealing with a routine HR issue. And in this introduction show, I want to provide some background for the true beginnings of Christianity and why the traditional story of those beginnings has so many problems. And I'll also provide an outline of our own theory. I call it the special paradigm, our working theory of the true origins of Christianity. And in the second half of the broadcast, I'm going to demonstrate the way we're going to cover the ancient texts that we'll examine on this show when I talk about a fragment from a lost book of a supposed Christian writer named Quadratus, who passes on a legend about people who were resurrected by Jesus and who lived until 120 AD. As we go forward in the coming weeks and months, we should always be asking why, if the original disciples of Jesus originated Christianity, and if the succeeding generations continued their work like they were simply passing on a baton in a relay race, then why do our texts from the middle of the second century reveal a belief system that's still largely unknown to the general public, except for, you know, those are those magic and exorcism guys? And why do the Christian documents from this period show such a lack of organization, such a lack of defined belief, and so much rivalry between large sectarian groups, each of which claim to have been around since the beginning? Always remember that the main underlying problem with the modern study of Christian origins is the assumption that Jesus was a historical figure and that his immediate disciples founded Christianity. It's the one error that's the source of all others. And if we can torch that assumption, only then can we begin to build on a secure foundation. Back after this. Something strange began to happen in the years after Alexander the Great and his successors had conquered the known world and threw its center of gravity towards the Mediterranean, towards the West. Prior to this, and going back into the very ancient period of humanity, religion had been centered around cultic sites, you know, performing service to the gods. And these were temples of the old gods, like the mud-brick monstrosities in the East that served the goddess Ishtar, depicted under the eight-pointed star and holding a cup filled with destiny. And these were national gods. Ishtar brags in one of the ancient writings that she has given birth to her dear people that fill the world like the sea is filled with so many fish. There was the Aphrodision in Acrocorinth with its 2,000 temple prostitutes in the service of the goddess of love and procreation, the divine protectress of that region. And there was a newer temple honoring another national god, that of Yahweh, the ancient Canaanite storm deity, now become the sole official deity of the Jewish religion that had been rather eclectic until then, if we read between the lines of the Old Testament. And this temple and this belief system had been established by the new hierocratic leaders of the Jewish people, who were more or less lieutenants of the Persian Empire. And they were charged with managing what was essentially a border march of the Persian state. And the way they did this was by structuring their society along religious and cultic lines. And this was like in the 5th century BC. But Alexander's conquest, like I said, basically unified the world as all of these various peoples perceived it. You know, ancient people did not think in terms of maps, like a top-down view that showed where they live and here's where all the other tribes lived. They rather tended to think of the world around them as lists of peoples. Like, they had a vague knowledge of where each nation lived in relation to the others. And beyond that, there was maybe a vague notion of like India and China off in space somewhere. So to them, the Greek and Roman empires had essentially unified the world. And this had a major impact on the traditional views of local gods as national protectors. And it had a major impact on religion. The role of religion in daily life itself had to be completely reimagined in this time when people began to see themselves less as members of city-states than as members of a civilized world, quite a new concept. Now, in the modern world, we would tend to see such a process as clean and organized. You know, you used to have these thousands of local cults. Now these are all beginning to transition into more universal religions that speak to daily experience and the inner life of the individual. But what's very striking is that for ancient people, this process was incredibly stressful. It was a difficult birth. And we see a cross-pollination of religious ideas that hadn't been possible in earlier eras, and not everyone was quite sure how to deal with it. But the main area of interest to us today is in the contact between Judaism and Greek philosophical ideas. In a late section of the book of Proverbs, we read the following, And the writer is talking about the personification of wisdom. From eternity, I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. When there were no ocean depths, I was born. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was born. When he established the heavens, I was there. And with this, we are beginning to see an infiltration of Greek thought into Judaism, a development of ideas from Plato and his successors, whose idea was that God was too transcendent and too perfect to interact directly with the world. And we begin to see in Judaism the idea that matter itself is corrupt and that the true center of our being is a pure, incorruptible spirit that must rise above the world of matter. The book called The Wisdom of Solomon says about this, "The corruptible body presses down the soul, and the earthly tabernacle weighs down the mind." And there's a new belief that the truly righteous, those pure in spirit, will be entitled to a resurrection. And note that this book was written over 100 years before the supposed death of Jesus. The Wisdom of Solomon says, "The souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and there no torment will touch them." Even though they're punished in the sight of men, their hope is full of immortality. Having been a little chastised, they shall be greatly rewarded, because God proved them and found them worthy of himself. What's changing here is Judaism in the first century BC as it comes into contact with Greek philosophy in this time when the old ideas of the national cults of the gods are dying out and being replaced with religious ideas about the life of the inner mind during the first and second centuries BC. And in this world, the traditional narrative of the Old Testament that God will lead his people to triumph is starting to encounter the political realities of the world after Alexander, when the Jewish people have become a mere buffer state between rival empires. And for that reason, we start to see a focus on God's redemption of his people rather coming at the end of the world in a great conflagration. And the heroic King Messiah who would lead the national triumph is reimagined. He's given a hard reboot in the apocalyptic writings. He starts to be imagined as a celestial figure, a heavenly hero. The book of Daniel from the second century BC talks about the Son of Man to whom dominion, glory, and a kingdom were given by the Ancient of Days that all people should serve him. In the Psalms of Solomon from the first century BC, the reign of the Messiah will be established not through force of arms, but wisdom and holiness. And 4th Ezra talks about the Messiah rising from the sea at the end of time, kind of like Emerald Weapon from Final Fantasy VII, to smash the enemies of God, along with the Shinra Corporation. The Book of Enoch says that the Messiah existed before the world was founded, and he will lead the righteous to live with God forever. And there's also evidence from this period, especially in Samaria, that this celestial savior was imagined to be Joshua, who was an ancient Canaanite sun god who was repurposed as the successor of Moses in the Old Testament. And Jesus is, of course, the Greek version of that name. There are also indications that the advent of the Messiah will be contrary to expectations. Because once you do this hard reboot, once you reimagine this Messiah concept for a confusing and changing world, you start to come up with ideas like the Messiah performing his redemptive acts through his own suffering. Now, the oracle of the book of Isaiah, chapter 53, had portrayed the nation of Israel as a servant of God who was wounded for our transgressions and crushed for our wrongdoings. But we begin to see this concept applied on a more personal level, combined with concepts like we read about in the Wisdom of Solomon. Again, let's lie in wait for the righteous man because he isn't useful to us. Let's see if his words are true. Let's test what'll happen at the end of his life. Because if he's God's son, God will help him and deliver him from the hand of his adversaries. Let's test him with insult and torture so that we might find out how gentle he is and make trial of his forbearance. Let's condemn him to a shameful death, because according to what he says, he'll be protected. That's from the second chapter of the Wisdom of Solomon, and it sounds uncannily like the trial of Jesus that's supposed to have taken place about a century later. I've often said that the true origins of Christianity could simply have come from a religious community imagining that that passage and the various other passages from Jewish writings that speak of a super celestial being created from the foundation of the world were in reality about the same person, and then they just construct the religious belief from there. In the first century BC, another new religious idea made its appearance, the idea that salvation and eternal life could come only from a knowledge of the true God and the knowledge of one's own spiritual nature. And this idea is called Gnosticism, which comes from a Greek word for knowledge. And this idea heavily infiltrated Judaism. In fact, it's a response to Judaism in many ways. Now, a belief system that presents the universe as being ruled by an all-powerful God doesn't seem like it would be the best environment for this idea that salvation comes from the knowledge of a true God who's otherwise imperceptible, but the Jewish Gnostics somehow made it work. They believed that the traditional God of Judaism, the God of the Old Testament, was actually an inferior being who ruled the world under the heavens through the malign influence of cosmic forces like the angels, the planets, and the signs of the zodiac, and one had to break free from his rule and learn about the transcendent God who existed outside of space and time. And the Gnostics found coded messages in the Old Testament to support this. They recontextualized biblical passages to reflect their own beliefs. And we find that in the earliest Christian documents, this kind of thing is already one of the main characteristics of the new religion. I mean, the early Christians are suspiciously comfortable with twisting Jewish Bible passages out of their original meanings and applying them to a new framework, almost as if they'd had decades of practice. But we find that the likely origins of Christianity are in variations of these Gnostic cults that sprang up in the first century AD and continued to develop all these ideas that we've discussed: the celestial savior, the end of the world, the spiritual resurrection of the righteous, the suffering Messiah, and the problem of evil in the visible world. And this view of the background of Christianity has already been discussed for decades. But what it basically comes down to a lot of the time is whether you're willing to believe that Gnosticism of the Jewish variety predated Christianity, or whether Gnosticism developed out of Christianity. But I think that that question is rather beside the point. Because when we turn now to the New Testament and to the earliest Christian writings, including other ancient Christian books like the Odes of Solomon, we don't suddenly find a new religion called Christianity emerging out of the mist in like the year 35 AD. When we open the New Testament, we don't find a fully formed religion that sprang forth from Judaism like Minerva leaping fully grown out of the head of Zeus. What we do find is that these 27 documents are actually the writings of different sects that originated at about the same time and were merged together at a later date. And the people who did the actual merging were very concerned to rewrite history and paper over the conflicts between the original Christian groups, which again, all originated independently. When these groups were merged together, the later Christian church couldn't afford to simply remove certain documents, like the letters of Paul are a big one. You can tell that whoever edited the New Testament had a major problem with the letters and the religion of Paul. But if they left out those documents, they ran the risk of alienating massive sects that they were trying to get on their side. And the result is that the New Testament books appear to show us the aftermath of a violent merger of distinct sects that each in their own way derive from Jewish gnosis and the new religious ideas that we talked about earlier. The main way to distinguish them from each other is really to put them all on a spectrum of where they might stand regarding traditional Judaism. I mean, some of these communities saw themselves as a true breakaway sect, a truly new religion. But others saw themselves as continuing within the orbit of Judaism. But the first thing that you should recognize on reading the New Testament is that whatever religion produced these documents, it was in the midst of a fairly heavy internal conflict when it did so. Almost all of the authors seem to be screaming over our shoulder at a rival teacher or a rival sectarian that's just out of sight. And we start to see this in the earliest New Testament books, which are said to be the letters of Paul. First of all, whoever originally wrote these letters did not believe in a flesh and blood, earthly Jesus who, you know, shook down a fish for money or ordered a Samaritan woman to give him water, even though he himself was standing 5 feet away from the same well. The idea of Jesus that emerges in the earliest layer of these letters is that of the celestial Messiah, called God's servant or God's son, who lives in heaven and will come at the end of the world to save the faithful. He won't come again, as in a second coming, but he will come, period. He has never been on earth. His saving act occurred at the foundation of the world, outside of time. This is in distinct contrast to the four Gospels, which have Jesus kind of strutting around like a character in an Arsène Lupin novel. Also, not only does the theology of Paul's letters often conflict from one to another, but it often conflicts within the same letter. The vocabulary, the style, the arguments shift dramatically from one passage to the next. The term Christian is never used in the letters, but are these then Jewish letters? Because the author sometimes presents himself as being a believing Jew with a favorable attitude toward his fellow Jews, but other times he portrays himself as a Gentile, having been completely outside of Judaism for his entire life, and looking now on the superstructure of Judaism with a mixture of resentment and contempt. The usual explanation for that, which is that Paul had to be all things to all people, is really just a catchphrase, and it's actually a catchphrase that comes from the documents themselves, which is a big no-no when you're examining one of these texts. The picture that emerges from a study of Paul's letters is that of a religious community that predated mainstream Christianity, but was later absorbed by the church, almost like a reverse Sunni-Shia split. The mainstream church, when it absorbed the religion of Paul, tried to fix the letters and edit them as best it could, but it was kind of like Richard Nixon trying to delete the Watergate tapes. They essentially just gave up like he did and just hoped for the best outcome. The first editor of the New Testament basically stuck these letters between the Gospels and some more acceptably Catholic letters and walked away whistling with his hands in his pockets. Now, as for the Gospels, we can immediately see that all of them are based on the Gospel of Mark in some way. And even the Gospel of John, which is the most free-floating composition, borrows elements from Mark and engages with and criticizes them. We get the sense that the stories of Jesus in the Gospels are actually tiny, self-contained narratives strung together to give the illusion of a complete ministry, pearls on a string. We get weird comments here and there from Jesus, like when he talks about the time of John the Baptist being in the distant past, even though John the Baptist had just gotten iced a few paragraphs earlier. And Jesus's main opponents in the Gospels are characters like Pharisees, scribes, and lawyers who sound suspiciously like the early rabbis who were reconstructing Judaism after the temple had been destroyed in the war with the Romans, you know, these early legalizing rabbis, who in fact didn't really exist until the very end of the first century. In the Gospels, Jesus opposes the Jews generally, who were already spoken of as belonging to a distinct and separate faith, something which wouldn't make sense considering that Christianity hadn't even been created yet, and the characters should pretty much all still be considered Jews at this point. The narrative of Jesus itself looks to be a compromise or series of compromises crafted for a church whose members' views about Jesus were at odds. And the trial of Jesus is said to be instigated by the Jews, which is highly suspicious given the fact that they didn't hold the civil power in that era. The whole story is possibly an allegory for the mainstream Jewish rejection of the idea of a suffering Messiah. It's a possibility, and that's the kind of thing we have to consider when re-examining these writings. We also encounter the Acts of the Apostles, a document that supposedly relates the history of Christianity after the resurrection. It conflicts mercilessly with Paul's letters. It presents Paul as a willing subordinate of the Jerusalem-based College of the Apostles, you know, this zealot who, in his letters, would curse anyone who preached a different gospel than him, is now made into a company man. And that's far from the only problem with this document, which is basically the main source of early church history and has been for almost 2,000 years. We get the distinct sense that the author is writing at a time long after Christianity was established, and he takes time to explain the backstory of why Christians are scattered throughout the world. It's a basic founding myth because in his time, there are Christians scattered throughout the world. And so he has to get from point A, which is the hazy and distant past, to point B, which is his own time. And he gives us an entire series of these sloppy, questionable foundation legends. He says that Christianity spread outward from Jerusalem under the strict oversight of the apostles. But for some reason, wherever they go, these same apostles keep encountering pre-existing Christians. You know, another thing, the author has to add characters like James, the leader of the church, that weren't yet invented when the Gospels were written. But the problem is that there's already an apostle named James, and so the author has to get him out of the way. So he has him killed off screen, basically, and then a few paragraphs later, he trots his own James character onto the stage. You know, and then Peter in Acts, in what is supposed to be like the first few months of Christianity, gives a speech where he describes the religion as having been preached since ancient days. And he does not mean this metaphorically. The author just slipped. We'll find in the coming weeks and months that Acts of the Apostles is like the gift that keeps on giving when it comes to seeing just how the ancient church fabricated its founding myth. But suffice it to say that for now, it presents too many problems for the traditional view of Christianity. Yet at the same time, we find nothing in it that conflicts with the idea that Christianity developed as a series of distinct sects that were later rolled into one religion. Now, the New Testament contains two letters that pass under the name of Peter. Neither were written by Peter. In fact, no New Testament book was written by its stated author at all. But the first letter of Peter seems like an attempt by mainstream Christianity at synthesizing the letters of Paul. You know, trying to digest the religion and the churches of Paul like a snake trying to digest a meal. It uses the term Christian. 1 Peter and Acts of the Apostles are the only two books in the New Testament to do so, and that's evidence in itself of a late date. But we also see something in 1 Peter which is highly important for our purposes and which will become a trend in most of the early Christian texts. The idea that the Christians are being persecuted, but the persecutors are never definitely identified, and the reason for persecution is never really specified. It's just a vague idea that Christians are being persecuted simply for being Christian. We're going to find that the earliest Christians did experience conflict on a local level, but that most of this conflict came at the hands of what we would frankly call other Christians. You know, the Roman Empire was not this militarized police state with security cameras on every corner looking for any instance of deviation from the state cult. The Romans tried and prosecuted people for crimes that were brought to their attention by informants for the most part, and no one hated each other and was more willing to drop the dime on one another than the earliest Christians. For example, the Church of Matthew's community calls out the Church of Paul's community and puts a condemnation of them into the very mouth of Jesus. So we're going to have to reimagine the entire narrative around persecution in the early church. You know, sometimes the persecutors of the ancient Christians are referred to as Jews. And in those cases, we have to hold open the distinct possibility that those persecutors were actually other Christians, who were simply closer to traditional Judaism than the persecuted people would have preferred. In the New Testament, we also find the letters of John. These are supposedly the records of an isolated community, almost like it's in the mountains, like in the film The Last Valley. But even in this tiny, out-of-the-way community, we still hear about conflicts with rival teachers and rival sects. Many deceivers have gone out into the world who don't acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. And there are two ways of looking at something like this. Either the traditional narrative is correct, and this religion is suddenly contending with rival teachers within a few years of its founding, or that those rival teachers had always existed, because the original Christian sects were always separate and merely thought that they had all come from the same source. And when they see rival teachers operating on their turf, they view them, frankly, as deviants. And we also have books like Revelation, which is actually a repurposed Jewish apocalypse. And in this book, we see that the early Christians are right back at it again, at each other's throats, and the author actually shanghais the cosmic Jesus into service as a mouthpiece to condemn the rival churches that he doesn't like. We may rightfully question whether it makes more sense that these desperate controversies emerge from Christianity itself, or whether they in fact predate official Christianity, and now, decades into its history, the various rival sects of Christianity are beginning to converge, and they're more like elements of a stew that hasn't been cooked evenly. Now, it may be asked, though, in all this, why I placed the origins of Christianity in the second century instead of the first. I mean, what's the difference? Once you remove the central figure of Jesus, couldn't it have developed just the same way, but in the first century? The answer to that has to do with two things. One is that when we look at the first Christian documents that appear to contain something which we would now recognize as Christianity, and those would be from about 200 AD, we work backwards from those and find that a few decades before those writings, our track goes cold. And so we either have to assume that Christianity arose in the first century, but entered a period of stasis for about 100 years before it began to develop again, or that the entire religion itself was born in the second century, and that those early texts accurately reflect that. And the other reason is that the second century itself was like the great age of popular religious feeling in this era. There were elements of the salvation and mystery cults for centuries prior, elements of the changes going on within Judaism and Platonism and Stoicism and other thought systems. But in the second century, we are now well within the era where these developments have become fully popularized and almost charlatanized, if you will. This is the period in which a wandering emissary of a cosmic deity who offers you salvation in exchange for a monthly stipend starts to make the most sense. Back after this. So we've talked about the picture that we get from the New Testament. But what about non-Christian sources in the early period? Well, we find that they are more or less completely silent when it comes to Christianity. Now, if you're familiar with Christ mythicism, the belief that Jesus was not a historical figure, then you already may know that there's a long list of the various Jewish and pagan writers of the first and second centuries that fail to mention Jesus. But a second look at their works will confirm that they don't seem to notice Christianity either. These include the great Jewish philosopher Philo, who died within a few years of the supposed resurrection. Also writers like Justus of Tiberius, he composed a history of Jewish affairs in the first century, didn't mention Jesus or Christians. Now, Josephus, another Jewish historian, is supposed to have mentioned both Jesus and Christians, but in time, I'm going to show that those references were added to his books by Christians much later. And I know some of you may have been wondering how I was going to tackle that. I'll cover that in a future show, and the same thing applies to the supposed references to Christians in Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny the Younger. But on the subject of Tacitus, for now, I'll note that the portion of his histories that would have covered events at the time of the death of Jesus has not survived to our own time. You know, it wasn't copied. The books of Tacitus dealing with the period before and after that have survived, so draw your own conclusions, I guess. The Roman poet Juvenal, despite being acquainted with urban life, despite making special notice of Jews, is unacquainted with Christians. Same thing with the satirist Martial. There was a Greek writer named Pausanias who lived from about 110 to 180 AD, and he drew up an extensive description of contemporary Greece. He was also familiar with Asia Minor, the old stomping grounds of the supposed ancient Christians. He doesn't make note of Christians at all. Florus Lucius, a historian in the reign of Hadrian, 117 to 138 AD, doesn't mention them. To this, we could add Seneca and Epictetus and Pliny the Elder and many others. Now, some might say that the silence of these writers is an invalid argument, but in many of these cases, in fact, most of them, we should expect these writers to mention Christians in connection with the subjects that they do write about. Because most of them do touch on local religions or Jewish customs or the general elements of Roman city life. It's a silence that speaks, and it speaks volumes. Now, later Christian history books tried to populate the first and second century with airy names of past prophets and leaders, you know, people like Clement, Ignatius, Ammia of Philadelphia, Onesimus. Often these figures are only mentioned in these texts. I mean, they're literary creations, literary legends. Our first actual datable witness for the Christian religion is Justin Martyr, writing in the middle 150s AD. And he as yet does not know of Paul or any of his letters. He in fact knows of no New Testament to speak of. He speaks of no organized structure of the religion other than like an informal congregation presidency. Christianity to him is a relatively new faith, which is still in dialogue with Judaism. And he gives us a patchwork of Jesus quotes, none of which really correspond to the content of the Gospels as we know them. But over the next several decades, our testimony starts to suddenly increase. We start to get writings from Christians like Tatian, Athenagoras, Melito, and others. And it's not clear from their writings, except maybe in the case of Melito, who's the latest among them, that this religion has yet developed into anything resembling the Christianity that's so familiar to us today. And perhaps not coincidentally, it's in this same period that the New Testament was actually being compiled. And also, not coincidentally, it's in this same period that we get our first external mention of Christianity by the pagan writer Lucian. We also have apocryphal writings from this period, like the Acts of Andrew and the Secret Book of John. And they show no knowledge of the New Testament stories and little to no familiarity with the ideas about Jesus that later became accepted in the church, despite the fact that these books are supposed to have been written nearly 150 years after the death of Jesus. Now, if you remember back to the beginning of this show, the quote from Celsus that depicted the Christians in his time of 180 AD as part of a kind of failing multi-level marketing scheme, we ask whether we get a similar picture from other sources in this time period. And we do. We see Justin Martyr trying to argue that Christian exorcists and magicians are much more effective than the more famous Jewish exorcists and magicians of his time. Almost like he's running ad copy, you know. Don't rely on the old remedies of Jewish magicians. Call a Christian exorcist today. We also see around this same time period the notion that Christianity is a religion that's being spread by wandering preachers and prophets, or wandering moochers, basically. The ancient church manual called the Didache says, "Let every emissary who's coming to you be accepted as if he were the Lord. But he's not to remain with you for more than one day. But if at any time there is a need, let him also remain one more day. But if at any time he remains for 3 days, he's a false prophet." End quote. And the same book also tells us, quote, "Whoever might say in the spirit, 'Give me silver pieces,' don't hear him out. But if at any time he might tell you to give to those who are lacking, let no one judge him." End quote. And the New Testament document 1 Timothy says that a lady is to be admitted into the order of widows if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet. And the saints there would be itinerant prophets. The earliest Christian religion was spread by these travelers who, in an era of religious zeal, spread the good message of redemption through belief in an immortal savior. And not until Irenaeus, at the very end of the second century, who can speak of the succession of all the churches throughout the world, do we start to get a different picture. The Christian religion developed out of new ideas within Judaism in the second century, and it developed in different instantiations around the Mediterranean. And the members of these disparate groups did not realize or did not care that the wandering preacher from the church down the street was from a completely separate and independent religion. You know, he's talking about Christ Jesus, he's talking about salvation, he's talking about the end of the world, so they assumed he's a Christian like me. And when it turned out that he started teaching things that were contrary to what the local community believed, the assumption then was that he was off message, he was a false teacher. It could not have been that he represented a totally separate and unique strain in the religious thought world of the second century. You know, this would have been beyond their comprehension back then. But at a certain point, when the Roman Empire's relations with Judaism in general began to break down, some enterprising leaders within these Christian sects realized that the way of the future was to absorb the rival Christian sects by playing down their differences, establishing a common foundation legend, and cultivating peaceful relations with the Roman state by differentiating this brand new religion from Judaism. This process happened in the middle of the second century. And the reason that Paul's letters are so confused and contradictory, the reason why the gospel account of Jesus doesn't make any sense, is that these enterprising leaders sandwich the beliefs of all these rival groups together. They cut out some of the most problematic ones, and that's why we don't get a gospel of the Hebrews in our Bible, for example, but they preserved what they could because this was a survival mission. And it's a much more plausible story for this religion that we still see in the second century as, you know, battling rival witches and spreading its message through glorified couriers who can't seem to articulate a unified message between them. And when it comes to the writings of the earliest Christians who are trying to tell us about the very beginnings of their faith, we should always remember that the past appears to be more obscure to them than it should be to us. Back after this. When it comes to the origins of Christianity, we assume nothing, but we ask why. We ask why Christianity doesn't emerge into the light of history until the writings of Justin Martyr in 156 AD. We ask why pagan writers don't mention Christians until Lucian mentions them in his books Alexander the Quack Prophet and The Passing of Peregrinus, and both of those were written in the 160s. They depict the Christians as nothing more than one curious sect among many, frantically competing for their dopey converts in the roadsteads and port towns of Asia Minor, just like any other sect. We ask why the first pagan refutation of Christianity, The True Doctrine by Celsus, wasn't even written until 178 AD, if then. We ask why the Christian writers of the second century are still hammering out very basic points of doctrine and belief, still struggling to differentiate themselves from Old Order Judaism as if the religion were still then in its infancy. And lastly, we ask why archaeological evidence for Christianity is not found at all, whether in decorated tombs or epitaphs, until the tail end of the second century. For we stand at the end of a road through a dark field, illuminated here and there by the lightings of vague watchtowers to suggest the path we should take. And these are the writings of those who came before us. For 200 years, they've sought to tame this wilderness. A voice crying in the desert, prepare the paths of the Lord, make his way straight, and all that. And we find ourselves at the end of this path, where the treasure that's been hid up for ages has long been concealed, that the Christian faith originated nearly 100 years later than previously supposed. And we give our statement of faith, as it were, in the words of Paul. For I deliver to you what I received from the beginning. That the scriptures of the Jewish Bible were written after the Babylonian exile and completed in the Hasmonean period. Its narratives are mythical, ideational, and non-historical. That these scriptures were the source material for the theosophic speculations which would become the foundation of Christianity. That the Christian religion developed in the second century from discordant backgrounds, from the Jewish apocalyptic and wisdom literature, from the Philonic speculation, from the ecstatic salvation cults and mystery religions, from the Barbello Gnosticism of the Samaritans, after the empire had replaced the national cults of the militant period of the city-state. That Christianity arose separately in multiple centers among charismatic sects who didn't understand that their sister sects didn't come from a common source and who engaged in fistfights, kidnappings, malicious prosecution, and running street battles with them and with the adherents of the Old Order Judaism. That the impetus for the creation of Christianity was the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple in 70 AD, the end of the cultic apparatus of mainstream Judaism, and the beginning of the era of the rabbis. That Jesus of Nazareth was not a historical figure, but the composite merger of a Gnostic savior deity and the super celestial messiah of the Samaritan Gnostic cults, who was eventually imagined in a retrospective legend to have lived as a man on Earth. That the religion of Paul developed independently in Western Turkey from Syrian Gnosticism, with Paul himself being a semi-mythical figure whose writings are late and composite. That the canonical Gospels are late and fictional, and for the most part based on an early version of the Gospel of Mark, which was itself written at the height of the Kitos Rebellion in 117 AD. That the great Jewish-Roman War of the 130s resulted in an irreparable breach between Judaism and Christianity, creating the perception by Christians and Jews that they were now members of two separate religions. And lastly, that the Catholic Church forcibly annexed its rivals, with the charismatic movement of Montanus being the last enemy to be destroyed. Led now by monarchical bishops and councils of elders, the Church began to base its history on the imagined traditions of the apostles and specific, limited, authoritative writings. Our survey ends with the close of the secular games held in Rome in the summer of 204 AD. A century prior to this, Christianity had been nothing more than an echo of an idea at the very fringes of Judaism, and it closes the period poised to capture and dominate the religious and intellectual life of the next 1,000 years and more. It is in this intervening period, the second century, that we must look for its origins. In 1993, the then World Wrestling Federation held what it called the Body Slam Challenge. The premise was that the 500-pound world champion, Yokozuna, would stand on the deck of an aircraft carrier in New York Harbor, and anyone who wanted to could attempt to lift him over their head and slam him to the ground. In doing so, they would get an opportunity to face him for the title at the next pay-per-view event. Now, of course, this competition was scripted, but one by one, athletes from the world of football or bodybuilding or professional wrestling would take their turn in trying to body slam Yokozuna. And despite a lifetime of strength training and athletic competition, none of them could manage to get the big man up. Now, why the hell do I mention Yokozuna and the body slam challenge in connection with the origins of Christianity? Well, as it turns out, it's a useful analogy for the inability of scholars to explain the day one origins of Christianity. Now, about 1,000 years ago, explaining the origins of Christianity was quite simple. All you had to know was that Jesus rose from the dead, appeared to his disciples, and that they then spread a religion based on his resurrection. But in modern times, scholars are forced to doubt the historicity of those post-resurrection appearances, you know, not to mention the historicity of the resurrection itself. Now, they can talk extensively about the life of Jesus by following the narratives of the Gospels. They can talk about his crucifixion and his death. But when they reach the moment wherein they have to triangulate the very first instance of belief in the resurrected Jesus, they can't do it. They're like those football players and bodybuilders who train for a lifetime only to find that they couldn't pick up Yokozuna for the body slam. After they get done discussing the death of Jesus, but before they discuss the first actual Christian churches, their narratives suddenly fill up with perhapses and no doubts and surelies. Because when we no longer believe in the mythical narrative, we find that we've lost a clear through line from the life of Jesus to the day one origins of Christianity. If we want to claim that someone like Peter had a vision of the resurrected Jesus and that was the origin of Christianity, then we fall into a whole host of new problems. For example, doesn't that conflict with the testimony of Acts of the Apostles? And so, if we decide to say that Christianity originated from a mass vision or mass hallucination, then we need to get our scissors ready and cut out the parts of the New Testament that explicitly conflict with that. Also, if the origins of Christianity lie in a subjective vision, then how did those first visionaries convince thousands of people to abandon their belief systems and embrace what even they call the scandal of the cross? But you'll find when you're reading any historical account of the origins of Christianity, and these days it's fashionable for people to want to read so-called historical accounts of early Christianity that haven't been tainted by religion, but the fact is that they're all tainted by religion because they all ultimately come from religious writings and religious sources. When you read a historical account of the origins of Christianity, even one that's purportedly secular, always watch out for the moment when the author has to explain the gap of time between the death of Jesus and the appearance of the very first Christian churches. And when you do that, think of those athletes in New York Harbor in 1993 at their moment of truth when they had to perform the impossible task of body slamming a 500-pound man. And you'll find that as these historians kind of squirm their way through it, that the body slam challenge is a useful analogy for the problems with the conventional view of Christian origins. Like, try as they might, they can't manage to explain the transition from the death and resurrection visions of Jesus to the beginnings of Christianity in a reasonable and logical way once they've lost that through line of the mythical narrative. If you were to ask an average person in the United States today how they believe Christianity originated, the answer would look something like this. Jesus of Nazareth, and they would say Jesus of Nazareth since they recognize that I guess Jesus Christ is a religious title and Jesus just sounds a bit lacking by itself. But Jesus of Nazareth was born to Jewish parents about 5 years on either side of 1 AD. Because they also recognize that 1 AD is not the correct date for the birth of Jesus, right? He was a religious teacher who taught Jewish moral precepts with some innovations. He was baptized by John the Baptist. That's another one of those indisputable facts. He performed healings and exorcisms, which were recognized as miracles by his followers, but which were probably psychosomatic or exaggerated. He ran afoul of the Jewish and Roman authorities by preaching the kingdom of God, which they read as like a pretension towards secular rule. He was duly executed by the Romans. At some time shortly thereafter, his earliest followers became convinced that they'd seen him risen from the dead, whether that was a dream vision or an outright hallucination. They adapted his teaching to reflect this new reality. The coming kingdom that Jesus had preached was actually his own messianic rule as the celestial savior who would return again at the end of the world, and that all who believed in him and kept his commandments would be spared punishment at the eternal judgment and would live forever in his heavenly kingdom. This belief system spread slowly among the Jews at first until an early Christian leader named Paul introduced it to a pagan audience. And from there, it developed through a series of controversies and setbacks into a universal church. Now, at first glance, that view does not seem like a religious one. After all, we said nothing about the stories about Jesus and his resurrection actually being true, so it seems to be rather a cold and dispassionate historical reading of the beginnings of Christianity. I mean, that's how it seems at first glance, but when you really examine this, you'll find that all of the information in this conventional view of early Christianity comes directly from the religious texts themselves. The only thing that's been really introduced is the possibility that the miracles and the resurrection story were subjective. For everything else, we seem to have collectively decided that whatever is possible is therefore historical. You know, it's possible that Peter believed that Jesus rose from the dead and convinced others of this fact, therefore it's somehow likely historical. So above all, we have to get away from this idea of reconstructing the background of Christianity by simply summarizing what its own religious texts say and just kind of whacking out all the obviously mythical stuff. It's something that we wouldn't do for the Iliad, for example, or for that matter, even for the Old Testament. It's what used to be done for those books prior to the 1800s or early 1900s or whatever, but it's fallen way out of fashion in other fields, yet it still prevails in the study of Christianity. As I said before, the first step is to eliminate our assumptions from the beginning, especially the assumption of a historical Jesus and an initial college of disciples or apostles. And lastly, I want to point out on this subject that in general, determining the day one origins of any religion is like holding an object over an event horizon, like in a Greg Bear science fiction novel. The object warps and shifts as we hold it, and we can't be certain what we're looking at any given time as we move and manipulate the object over the distorting matter. I mean, how much do we really know about the day one origins of something like the Ordo Templi Orientis, for example, you know, from the beginning of the 20th century? How much do we really know about the day one origins of Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard's specific internal thought processes? How much do we really know about Joseph Smith's religious development in like the early 1820s? Can we pin down the day one origins of Mormonism with any confidence? I mean, the true origins, not what the church itself says are the origins. And these are modern belief systems constructed in the full light of history, relatively modern. I mean, how much more impenetrable must the day one origin story of an ancient religion like Christianity be to us? Great religious movements do not require a neatly curated foundation story. And that's true even of the religious movements that are developing right now in our own time. Think of things like QAnon. And we live now in the era in which information is archived and readily available and accessible. Now, how much more obscure, then, should the beginnings be of religions that arose in the world of 2,000 years ago? In an era of great popular religious feeling, an era of hunger for salvation and deliverance from the cosmic enemies of humanity. As St. Gordy says, in a certain sense, it may be said that Christianity had a founder or founders insofar as certain men developed and spread abroad ideas which had come to them from an earlier time. They carried on propaganda and established communities. And the basis of their propaganda was the divinity of Jesus. Back after this. Before leaving off, we should engage in some radical criticism today. And we're going to be dealing with an early Christian writing called the Fragment of Quadratus. This is a very brief document, it's actually only one sentence, that shows up in the writings of the historian Eusebius from the 300s AD. And he's supposedly quoting from a lost book by this writer. Now, Eusebius mentions two people called Quadratus. One he identifies as a prophet, and the other he identifies as a writer of apologetics, meaning that this person wrote defenses of Christianity, whether directed toward Jews or pagans. And this fragment is supposedly from Quadratus, the writer of apologetics. But Eusebius gets confused, as often happens with him, and doesn't really differentiate between the two. Now, Eusebius says that Quadratus wrote his apology when Hadrian became Roman emperor, and we know that that happened on August 8th, 117 AD. He says that Quadratus wrote a discourse containing an apology for Christianity because certain wicked men had attempted to trouble the Christians. And this goes back to what I said earlier. The early Christians are always supposedly being persecuted, but for some reason, we can never get a clearly defined sense of who's actually doing the persecuting. And that applies here. I mean, now, Eusebius says that this book by Quadratus is said to still be in the hands of a great many of the brethren. Now, this is another huge issue because, does this mean that he's actually quoting from the book? Like, does he actually have it in front of him? I mean, like, that wording, the idea that it's said to still be in the hands of many, is really somewhat odd if he did, in fact, have the book open in front of him. Like, his wording is creating an issue that wouldn't exist if he had just said, like, okay, folks, here's a book by Quadratus, and I'm about to quote from it. It's one of the many instances where what he's not saying is more significant than what he is saying. Like, if I had a Harry Potter book open on my desk right now, it wouldn't occur to me to guess whether it was in wider circulation or not. After all, I own the book, so I can safely assume that other people also own it. And yeah, I get that books weren't distributed nearly as widely back then, and Eusebius himself ran a Christian library and might have been able to get his hands on some rare books, but his wording seems to suggest that he doesn't have the book, and he's copying a mere excerpt from it that he happened to find in his library. And this is kind of a common practice, not only with him, but with many other ancient Christian writers. Often, they only have access to a few quotes by a particular author, but when they convey these quotes, they give the impression that they not only have the whole book in front of them and mastered not only that book, but that they've mastered every other thing that the author ever composed. And, you know, Jerome in particular is famous for that. But anyway, Eusebius next says that Quadratus wrote this book for the Emperor Hadrian when Hadrian was visiting Athens. Now, the name Hadrian is of significance here because later Christian authors would commonly date the beginnings of heresy to Hadrian's reign. This is because there was a floating piece of tradition in the church to the effect that an apostle named John, one of the original 12 disciples, lived until the time of Hadrian's predecessor, Trajan. And the early church was in the habit of declaring that no heresies were able to form while the apostles were still living, because the apostles would immediately have corrected them. Because, you know, like that's how that works, right? The apostles are kind of like the Nazgul of the Hellenistic world. They can instantly sense whether anyone anywhere is teaching a deviation from Christianity, and then I guess they go fly there and correct it on the spot. But because of this, the activity of most of the heretics like Basilides and Valentinus is placed by church historians in the reign of Hadrian, simply because it must have been the case that they didn't operate before that time during the time when the apostles were still living. And this is also actually done by modern historians as well. Like, you could go buy a book printed in like the last 5 years and it'll tell you that, yeah, Basilides and Valentinus originated in the reign of Hadrian. They have no evidence for this other than what the ancient church said. And as we'll see, they're basing it on pretty much nothing. So whenever you see a Christian historian of any time period attributing something to the reign of Hadrian, your sixth sense should immediately activate. Now, I'm going to read the whole fragment of Quadratus. It's very short. Quote, "But the works of our Savior were always present, because they were genuine, those that were healed and those that were raised from the dead, who were seen not only when they were healed and when they were raised, but were also always present, and not merely while the Savior was on earth, but also after his death. They were alive for quite a while, so that some of them lived even to our own day." Probably one of the sloppiest fucking compositions ever written. But anyway, it begins with the word "but," implying that the author is contrasting the miracles of Jesus with some other miracles, miracles that the author regards as not being genuine. And he goes on to describe healings as well as multiple people being raised from the dead. Now, the language of this fragment sounds very similar to the sort of thing that we read in Christian theologians from the end of the second century. Remember, this is supposed to have been written in like the 120s AD or so, you know, or possibly the 130s. Now, those end of the second century theologians are in the middle of a struggle with the Gnostic Christian groups in their time. And there's a pretty heavy emphasis on those groups using magic and conducting miracles of their own. Irenaeus describes a Christian heretic, a magician named Marcus, who performs a magic trick that makes it look like blood from an angelic being has filled a cup, which he then gives to his followers to drink. And Irenaeus says that Marcus is regarded by his senseless and crack-brained followers as working miracles. And later, he says that Christian heretics like Simon Magus and Carpocrates are also said to perform miracles, but he also says the following. He says, "They can neither confer sight on the blind, nor hearing on the deaf, nor chase away all sorts of demons, except those that are sent into others by themselves, if they can even do this." And then Irenaeus goes on to make one of the most enormous statements that we encounter in these ancient writings. He says that these heretics are unable to raise the dead, as Jesus and the apostles had been able to do, but he then says that this has also been frequently done in the church in his day. That is, in 190 AD, the church was raising people from the dead, according to him. The entire church engages in fasting and prayer, which supposedly results in the return of the spirit of the dead man. Modern Christians tend not to accept this account for obvious reasons, or what should be obvious reasons, but it's notable that in all this, Irenaeus doesn't cite the writings of Quadratus. They seem to be completely unknown to him, but we can see from these passages where Quadratus is coming from. He's writing within a genre that owes much to the struggle with rival Christian groups at the turn of the 3rd century. And we note also that in this fragment, Quadratus says that some of the people raised by Jesus lived even to his own day. And it should be noted that that phrase, "to our own day," is kind of a catchphrase of Eusebius. He says it right at the beginning of his book when he talks about the confessions that have been made in our own days. He says that a letter of Dionysius of Corinth has been retained down to our own days. He says that the philosopher Porphyry lived in Sicily in our own times. Eusebius is also famous for being the only source for a lot of like these short, fragmentary Christian writings, and at least 5 of them that he quotes contain this exact phrase, not including the fragment of Quadratus. We can draw our own individual conclusions here, but 2 possibilities seem likely. Either this was a Christian text from a much later time than the reign of Hadrian, or it was forged by Eusebius himself. Now, I realize that both of those things can be true at the same time, but the question is whether it's genuine and late or forged by Eusebius. We should also note that it assumes knowledge of the Gospels because Jesus does heal and raise multiple people in those books. And by my reckoning, the earliest gospel wasn't produced until about 120 AD and didn't gain widespread currency until the following decade. So whoever wrote this knew not only the Gospels, but was also at least subconsciously aware that the church was trying to claim direct continuity from Jesus into a fairly late period. Because the mere fact that people raised from the dead by Jesus are still living serves as a kind of proof of the legitimacy of Jesus. You know, it's like as long as those people are still alive, they're living proof that not only was the historical flesh and blood Jesus legitimate, but also the church narrative surrounding the historical flesh and blood Jesus was legitimate. In other words, if anyone tries to argue any differently about the early days of Christianity than what the official church believes, then they're going to have to explain just how it was that these people, these contemporaries of Jesus, lived for another 80 years after his death. And that's why this fragment was written. Now, there's no way of verifying this information. It would be hard to figure out even today how you would verify such information. Like, if someone told you that in the Civil War in the U.S., there was a magician that raised people from the dead, and those people lived up until 1940 A.D., where do you start if you wanted to verify that? Like, I guess you could look up the Social Security death records, but they're not going to tell you that these fools were raised from the dead by a magician 2 generations before that. What this fragment of Quadratus demonstrates is that there are no reliable sources for the early history of Christianity precisely because these forged documents themselves are the sources. These documents were forged in response to the lack of primary sources. If there was externally verifiable evidence of the ministry and the miracles of Jesus, then the fragment of Quadratus would never have had to have been forged in the first place. And Eusebius himself is a party to this because it needs to be noted that the only reason he cites this document is to demonstrate that Quadratus was an early writer. Because when Eusebius does his church history, and he was the first to ever write a history of the church, he runs across the very same problem that we're running across right now, which is that the first decades of Christianity, if we assume that Christianity began in the 30s AD, its first decades are an absolute dark age. So he either finds or forges this document that looks like it could have come from that early period, which to him and to us is an absolute blank. And he proudly sticks it in there like, oh, thank God, I found another source that I can kind of stick in there and bridge the gap. He brags that this document reveals the early date at which Quadratus is writing. Like, he cares not so much about the world historical miracles of those resurrections, but he cares more about the fact that he's finally managed to find a Christian source that covers the early second century. So when it comes to things like this, we should never blindly accept the testimony of the early Christian writers, especially Eusebius, who was one of the least scrupulous characters in this connection that you could possibly imagine. The fact that so much of the early Christian history passed through his hands, and he's the only source for a lot of this early stuff, is a highly significant challenge. But for whatever reason, he gets inexplicably praised by modern scholars for his probity and his attention to detail, which are just about the last two fucking things that come to mind for me personally when I think of Eusebius. We've seen some evidence today that the conventional way of looking at Christian origins is unhelpful and should be discarded, whether it's the lack of external testimony or the contradiction of the internal testimony. We've also seen how everything that we've been told about Christian origins comes from a fictional narrative that was developed by the early church to explain the circumstances of its own founding. Christianity emerged from the second century as just one strain of a Jewish heresy that survived. We began to demonstrate an alternative way of explaining how Christianity began, one that takes all the evidence into account and addresses the many contradictions and problems. This is the abandoned road that we'll continue to follow. We provided some background for the true beginnings of Christianity and why the traditional story of those beginnings has so many problems. We also provided an outline of the special paradigm, which is our working theory of the true origins of Christianity. And we also exposed the fragment of Quadratus as a fraud, but in doing so, we demonstrated the critical view of reading and examining these ancient texts. We will continue to ask and answer the question as to why the early sources paint such a different picture of Christianity than the conventional story does. Above all, we have to eliminate from our minds the assumption that Jesus was a historical figure and that his immediate disciples founded Christianity. We close today with another reading, and this one is from the great Saint Eddie, Edwin Johnson, a hero of radical criticism. Writing in the year 1887, he says, "We hold that the Christian world has for ages been content for the most part and is still content to beg the question of the historical origins of Christianity under the influence of the old Catholic fathers, that is, under the influence of men who were ignorant of the history of the church, which they administered with so much skill. Men who were content to fill the void in their knowledge with poetical fancies, and who probably encouraged the circulation of historical fictions which tended to support their apostolical pretensions with their flocks." Thank you for listening. Join us next time. This criticism is ended. Go in peace.
Walk on water, reside in the realm of mythology. Gnostics call the literal resurrection the faith of fools. What you are is a follower of Eusebius. Presuppositions are not safe here. It's in the gospel.